Parshas Toldos is a very rich and fertile parsha for Svarim names. And obviously not the Sefer, but the person, one of the most prodigious Talmudists and Talmidei Chachamim in Jewish history to really reshape the way we study Torah. He didn't write that many Svarim, and the one Sefer, one of the few Svarim he wrote, isn't really named based on the parsha, but of course his very name. And I'm referring to none other than Rashi's grandson, Yaakov ben Yocheved and Meir, Yaakov ben Meir, who was one of the leading Balei HaTosfos, and because his name was Yaakov, most people assume it's because of that, he became known proverbially as Rabbeinu Yaakov ben Meir, became known as Rabbeinu Tam. Based on this week's parsha, Yaakov Ish Tam Yoshev Ohalim. Who was Rabbeinu Tam? question that that require hours and hours to answer. 12th century French grandson of Rashi, Rashi's daughter Yocheved, one of Rashi's daughters married with Meir. They had four children, it seems like four children. Three of them are known to us as Mefarshim, more or less Balei HaTosfos. One is Rabbeinu Shmuel, the oldest, who was the Rashbam. Second is Rabbeinu Yitzchak, who became the Rivam. And the third was Rabbeinu Yaakov Ishtam. It's hard to compare and contrast, but one could say that He was the most surpassing of the three. He was clearly the Gadol Hador, clearly recognized as such, certainly in the French theater. People delivered shilos to him. People spoke about him in terms that were reverential. His Talmud, Reb Chaim Bal HaTosfos, one of the Balei HaTosfos who learned with Rabbeinu Tam, was Reb Chaim. Rabbeinu Tam's Talmidim were the entire world of Tosfos in France. He essentially converted French into a Torah center. Two of the most well-known is Rabbeinu Eliezer of Metz, who wrote the Sefer Yerayim, Rabbeinu Shimshon of Shams, who wrote a lot of Tosfos in, but one of his Talmidim was Reb Chaim Cohen. Reb Chaim, of course, was a Cohen. Reb Chaim Cohen said that had he been there when Rabbeinu Tam was Nifter in 1171, 12th century, he was born about 1100, he would have been Metame, because there wouldn't be a concept of a kahuna, of Cohen, on the day that Rabbeinu Tam left this world. So Rabbeinu Tam essentially leads the Tosfos movement, and for people who study Gemara, the role of Tosfos is almost intuitive, as it is seminal. But for those who don't study Gemara, for those who've studied haven't thought about it in this way, Tosfos articulated an idea, an impulse, an instinct, which was tacit and is tacit when we learn Shas, and that is that all of Shas is one network of logic. And it's, even though it presents itself as divided into compartments and topics and mesechtos and discussions and sigyos, the logic is all integrated. And these Tanaim and these Amoraim were so in such command of the logic, in such command of the system, that they would not issue statements that were logically contradictory. And when you learn a sugya, and again, because of our limitations imaginatively and time-wise, we tend to bear in on the text in front of us and the details of the text. You have to be reading in unison or in parallel all the other sugyos, even those which aren't direct cross-links, which discuss the exact same topics, but which discuss topics with even slightly overlapping logics. And when there's a contradiction, that contradiction has to be resolved. And they believe so deeply in this assumption that they were willing to employ a tool that a lot of people on the outside who haven't studied Shas are a little bit suspicious of, sometimes derisive of, but if you're an insider to Shas, you realize that it's a powerful reflection of a certain theoretical perspective on Shas, and that's the power of Ukimta, where it tells us, we'll ask a question, compare two sugyos, and then say, well, that sugya is only dealing in a very, very particular case, and he shrinks the scope, and it's only talking about this case, even though the Gemara presents it as a global halacha. Now, some people roll their eyes and say, well, how could Tosfos impose such a strict shrinkage when the Gemara presents it as a global case and Tosfos says it only applies in this scenario and that scenario? It's because, logically, there's no other way. And I'd rather say, whenever people talk to you, that you have to contextualize what they're saying. If you know that they love you and they say something which sounds off, you say, oh, they probably mean it this way or that way. And if you know that they dislike you and they say something which is kind, oh, they probably have this malicious intent involved or that malicious intent. So we don't just look at the text of our communication, but we study the context. And for Tosfos, the context was all of Shas and all the integrated logics. It's obvious that Chazal will never say something that's logically counterintuitive or contradictory, so it must be that when they articulated logic in a different sugya that contradicts the logic in our sugya, one of the sugyas must be referring to a very specific set of circumstances and a very specific set of parameters. So Tosfos, again, we're so accustomed to this, but really Tosfos was the first, or one of the first, to articulate this as a system. Chazal thought about it intuitively. See, Rashi didn't write in a way that would allow or encourage this type of cross-sugya parallels. From time to time, Rashi introduces it, but in the world of Tosfos, it becomes explosive and dominant, and from Tosfos onward, it's obvious that if you're writing about a particular sugya, you have to take into account all the other parallel sugyas, both that are directly overlapping or only slightly overlapping. What's interesting about the Beinei Tam also is that living in the 12th century in France, inevitably you're experiencing the Crusades, and experiencing a very, very two personal moments, 1146, 1171, in the city. I remember the entire 12th century is rivers of blood running through it. And I think in the 1146 Crusade event, or around Chivor's time, he actually was captured or caught in a field by some thugs, and they were about to kill him, and I think they either started to or they wanted to drive five stakes through his body to take revenge for Jesus being crucified, one through the head. Now, I'm not sure if they started the process or they wanted to, but there was a very wealthy Jew who rode by and redeemed Rabbeinu Tam for a very exorbitant sum of money. What's interesting about this is Rabbeinu Tam is influential in converting one of these days into a day of Slichos and Tainus, which was kept in Europe for many, many hundreds of years. And also, the Rabbeinu Tam is responsible for a very interesting psak that a person is allowed to inflict damage on himself and even, of course, to commit suicide. He explores the option if he knows that by being captured, he'll be subjected to torture into Averos, which is counterintuitive. We think that you're not allowed to commit suicide, it's murder, and it becomes, of course, a very, very famous tshuva, and sadly, a very, very relevant tshuva in the medieval period. What's also interesting is the Rabbeinu Tam is a feminist. Now, when I say that Rabbeinu Tam is a feminist, that could conjure many different expectations amongst listeners of the 21st century, because feminism to us means one thing, but for the Rabbeinu Tam in the 12th century, it's trying to support women's needs in that context. And I think, again, sometimes we look back anachronistically, we look back at previous generations, and, oh, they treated women this way, treated women that way, it doesn't accord with our sense of righteousness and justice. It's all socially contextual and what was appropriate in that community, and that's those social norms. And we don't look back at previous societies as being backwards or Neanderthals. Just societies evolve in some ways, and they devolve in other ways. And so what were the burning issues facing women in those days? And the issues, of course, and they're never really women's issues. They're communal issues, because we live as communities, and especially when they speak to marriage, they're not women's issues, they're marital issues. And because of the trauma of Crusades, what was happening was men were marrying women, were receiving large dowries, and then were the women, sadly enough, were being taken advantage of by the Crusades, captured by the Crusaders, raped, murdered. So you had all these marriages that ended very, very quickly after they began, but the monies of the dowry had already been delivered to the husbands. And now, imagine you offered a very large dowry for your daughter to marry someone, and then sadly, tragically, your daughter was no longer available, was raped, was taken captive at a very early stage of the marriage, and the marriage ended, the marriage terminated, let's say she was killed. And now all your money that you had intended as a dowry so that you can see your daughter live a comfortable life and raise children and build a family, now these monies were transferring immediately to some other family, and obviously he's your son-in-law, but he's been your son-in-law for a week, chas v'shalom. So because of that, parents were withholding dowries from their daughters, and because of that, women weren't getting married. And remember, it's not like you were living in New York City or in Tel Aviv where you were J-Date and endless shiduchim and shidduch organizations. You're living in small, relatively smaller surroundings, and the options weren't that great, and any slight deterrence could really block and thwart the entire system. So Rabbeinu Tam made a takana, if I'm not mistaken, that within a year, If the woman were, if the marriage ended, of course, you have to make a global takana. If the marriage ends within a year of its inception, then the dowry money should revert back to the wife's parents. So parents are more, felt more comfortable offering dowries because they had a year window. If the marriage ended, again, in most cases because of traumatic and tragic reasons, in some cases marriages end within a year or shorter periods, the monies revert back. And this greased the wheels for marriages, for dowries, for marriages to take place. Some of the other takanos he made that serviced women, you couldn't divorce your wife without a reason. Men were just divorcing their wives indiscriminately. Not sure if this is crusader related, but certainly not something we want to propagate. You know, again, sometimes this is me talking personally. Sometimes I feel abraded when people refer to these as women's issues. They're not women's issues. They're communal issues. They're marital issues. They're, I'm not a woman, but I've got four daughters, and I want them to be cared for, just like I want my boys to be cared for. So it's hard to call these women's issues, but sometimes we get trapped in thinking that the only important women's issues are the ones that are important in their own right, but that seek to create equality in certain areas of previous inequality. Another issue is that he made a takana that no gittin can ever be questioned. Once a get's been processed and authorized and validated and issued, in current era, I'll get. There's no checking, back-checking, because it could obviously create chaos. Once a get has been issued by a particular base, then that get has to be treated as sacrosanct. So these are some of his takanos that he's known for. Now, of course, what's also interesting is that he's known for, and he carries enough weight that even his dissenting opinions still proliferate through halachic system, and even though we quote-unquote paskin against them, they still become compelling in the halachic universe. And I'm referring, of course, to the two most famous shittos of Rabbeinu Tam, that even though they're paskin against and we by and large don't adhere to them, these shittos still operate within the halachic system. People are machmir. One is the tefillin of Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam had a machlokas with Rashi about the sequence of parshios of the Torah that are how they're inserted into the tefillin shel Rosh primarily, exclusively that's the machlokas. And the second issue was, of course, the Banish Mashas, of Banish Tam's calculation of Banish Mashas and Shkia and Seis yields a later transition from the previous day to the next day. And even though mainstream halacha paskined against Rabbeinu Tam, you still have people today who wear the tefillin of Rabbeinu Tam. You still have people today who keep the shir of Rabbeinu Tam after Shabbos. Now, again, just for those who aren't that halachically attuned, more people are machmir about this man Rabbeinu Tam, even though they won't wear tefillin Rabbeinu Tam, again, because wearing tefillin Rabbeinu Tam is associated with grandstanding religiously and exhibitionism, and that's called yuhara. So to actually stand up in shul and put on a separate tefillin of Rabbeinu Tam, those who don't, I'm not in no way excoriating those who do, but those who don't feel that even though they're machmir for Rabbeinu Tam in certain contexts, they're not going to be machmir in a way that would be bordering on exhibitionism in religion. Anyway, what also makes Rabbeinu Tam unique, I want to get to a couple other svarim, is he's one of the only Balei Tosfos to actually write a sefer. Most of the Balei Tosfos convey their ideas morally. Rabbeinu Tam supposedly sat in a base medrash with 70 great Talmidei Chachamim, all of the caliber of Rav Avi Yosef. You can imagine sitting in front of people who had the command of Torah, like Rav Avi Yosef, but 70 of them. But most of the Tosfos in were written secondhand by Talmidim, which is why it happens to be one of the great, I won't call it tragedies, but it's one of the sad points is that Tosfos and the Balei Tosfos, who were so creative and so pioneering and so innovating, they didn't actually sit down to write their thoughts in a coherent and straightforward fashion. So they're written down secondhand by students, and there was written stream of consciousness. And let's face it, Tosfos is really difficult. So the most difficult sefer to read, probably. And it creates great allure and great romance and Amelus Batar, you have to knock your head five times against the wall just to read a line in Tosfos, but it would be a different world if Tosfos were written, let's say, like the Ritva were written, or if Tosfos were written like the Ketzos were written, tight, clear, straightforward, organized. We'd be able to get to the bottom of Tosfos much quicker. Some parts of Tosfos we don't fully understand what they mean. So one of the great, I mean, call it tragedies, hard to say, call Tosfos a tragedy, one of the unfortunate aspects of Al-Masara, that Tosfos wasn't written in a more organized fashion. Rabbeinu Tam did write some of his chidushim around in a sefer called Sefer HaYashar. Sefer HaYashar Rabbeinu Tam. It's a sefer that yeshiva people are well familiar with. It's not as comprehensive as his statements quoted here and there throughout Shas, but it's certainly a sefer worth mentioning. Okay, so this is the sefer of the Rabbeinu Tam. Now, Yaakov spends his time in an ohel. There's an ohel Yaakov that he, Esav is busy in the field, but Yaakov is in the ohel Yaakov. And the ohel Yaakov is the name of a very interesting sefer written by none other than Rabbi Yaakov Krantz. Rabbi Yaakov Krantz was, for us, we call him the Duvna Magid. The Duvna Magid, late 18th century, early 19th century, the most famous Magid in a period in which there were Magidim covering the countryside, delivering Musar. There's actually a job called the Magid. He's born in a city near Vilna, and ultimately he moves to Galicia, and then becomes 18 years, he lives in the city of Dubna nearby, and in Poland, and he is well known and well associated with the Vilna Gaon, who, there were many Magidim during that period, and the Dubna Magid was probably the most famous one, and the Vilna Gaon persistently asked for the Dubna Magid to come give drashos, and the Dubna Magid initially was resistant, but then he came, and very interesting relationship between the Dubna Magid and the Vilna Gaon. Probably the two aspects I would highlight is, number one, as opposed as the Gaon was to Chassidus, and as militant as the Gaon was against Chassidus, Dubna Magid did not join him in that process. And it's an interesting comment to contextualize and frame the Dubna Magid in his place in history, because this, of course, was the period of the rise of Chassidim, and Chassidus Rebbeim also traveled the countryside and also delivered fables and stories, and the Magidim tried to play that role in the Litvish world, in the non-Hasidish world, and I think to a degree, I wouldn't say they were usurped, but we hear about the Dubna Magid, we hear stories of other Magidim, but to a degree, the Hasidic Rebbeim stole their thunder. They became much more charismatic, and they captured the hearts of the common man. They were Dubna Magidim, were not discussing sugyos, they were discussing stories, Musar, and moralisms, and homiletics, and modern-day drashos, and the Hasidim just were discussing it in ways that are just more riveting, Kabbalistic, more of a movement. So I think that the Magidim don't get enough airtime, we don't know enough about them. And then the second movement that I think steals their thunder, but that moves in on the space of the Magidim, is the Musar movement. And the Magid is right at the verge of the Musar movement. He passes in 1804, and then the Musar really takes off with Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. So it's interesting to imagine how important the Magidim were and how important the Dubna Magid was. The Vilna Gaon wanted the Dubna Magid to come and essentially deliver Mishalim, deliver stories and fables. And I mean, evidently, Moshe Mendelssohn met the Dubna Magid, and he called him the Jewish Aesop. Aesop was a Greek poet who delivered fables and homilies and stories spoiled grapes and spoiled fruit and poisoned fruit and all the famous fables that we read about and the fox in the water. And I don't think the Dubna Magid supposedly didn't take kindly to that association, but essentially they were describing the living Musar. It wasn't heavy-handed Musar. It wasn't the fire and brimstone Musar of the early Musar movement about Gehenna and about death. It was probably a little more empowering, a little bit more thoughtful, but the frame and the shell wasn't sugyos and it wasn't midrashim. The frame and the shell was stories. Let me describe probably the most famous story in Mashal of the Dubna Magid. They once asked him, how come your fables, your mishalim, your parables are so precise and they always are so cutting and appropriate? So he says, let me give you a mashal. The Magid said about himself, where he's walking in the forest and he sees hundreds of trees with arrows in them, literally hitting dead center on the target. People would use trees for target practice. And then he sees a man walk by, or a child walk by with a bow and arrow. So the man asks him, are you the archer? And the child says, of course I am. So the man says, how can you be so precise? How can you be so accurate? So the boy said, well, I just shot my arrows. So the man says, how could you hit with such precision? So he says, well, first I shot the arrow, and then I drew the target. And it became almost like a phrase, to shoot an arrow, then draw a target, to like make a previous decision. We say it a bit derogatorily, make decisions and then build narratives around it. But the Dubna Magid was describing this, that he first tells a story, and then I guess he meant that the story should Then he decided what idea and message to draw from the story. But it's interesting to think about the role of the Magid in that period of Chassidus pre-Musar. Anyway, the other aspect of the Vilna Gaon, evidently the Magid was, I don't say critical, it's hard to be critical of the Vilna Gaon, but he certainly wasn't supportive of the Vilna Gaon's decision to retreat into his own Dalet Amos and not to be involved in day-to-day life. In any event, he didn't publish during his lifetime, but after Rabbi Yaakov Krantz passes, 40 years after, I think they were written, he would write down Rishimos, he'd write down scribble and then texts about the midos that a person should live by. And about 40 years after, I think he passes, or after they were written, they were found in a Geniza in Meshritz. And they were published by a man named Avram Dov Flam. They were published into a sefer called Kol Yaakov. So the primary sefer of the Dubna Magid, for those who want to read his Mishalem, is called Kol Yaakov, based on Parshas Toldos, HaKol, Kol Yaakov, V'Hayadayim Yidei Esav. Now, there's another sefer by a very famous author, very far from Poland, very far from the Dubna Magid. This is Rav Yaakov Chaim Sofer. Yaakov Chaim Sofer is born in Tafresh Lamed, which is about 150 years ago. He's born in Baghdad, and he dies in the 20th century, 1939. He's a Mechaber, Pasek Halacha. He's a Mekubal, and he's well-known, of course, as being the Mechaber of the Sefer Kaf HaChaim. Kaf HaChaim, the best way to phrase it is, Kaf HaChaim is what one would call the Sephardic Mishneh Berurah. He's quoting the Shulchan Aruch and the Poskim, and he's giving commentaries, and probably even broader than the Mishneh Berurah. Mishneh Berurah is streamlining what the Pesach is. Kaf HaChaim brings all the Shittos, and he's Machria. And again, since it's a Sephardic Pesach, it's much more flavored with Kabbalah, which you don't necessarily have that much of in the Chafetz Chaim. So the Kaf HaChaim, which is 10 volumes in Or HaChaim and then one volume in Yerodea, is his primary work. This is the Yaakov Chaim Sofer, but as his name indicates, he was a Sofer, and that's how he supported himself. And this Sofer wrote a Sefer on Dinei Safras, and Hilchos Sefer Torah Tefillin and Mezuzos, and this Mechaber of the Sefer Kaf HaChaim, whose name was Yaakov Chaim Sofer, he named his halachic work Kaf HaChaim, but he named his smaller work on Dinei Safras, he named it Kol Yaakov. So you've got two svarim within about 200 years. Couldn't be more different, couldn't be more geographically discrepant. They're two totally different figures, and they each, again, the Dubna Magid didn't call the Sefer Kol Yaakov, but the Sefer became known as Kol Yaakov. One final Sefer, just to take us to a very, very different era, very different type of a Sefer, in the 11th century. So this is about 100 years before the Rabbeinu Tam lives, and this is not in France, this is in Spain. So one of the great early, remember this is the early Spanish era, one of the great members of the early Spanish era was Rabbeinu Yitzchak ben Rabbi Yehuda ibn Giat, known affectionately as the Ritz Geat, Rabbeinu Yitzchak ibn Giat. And he's living in the early part of the 11th century in Spain. He let's say, had contact with Reb Shmuel HaNagid. These are early Rishonim, Spanish Rishonim. He's a contemporary of the Rif. In fact, there was a saying that there were five great people living through his era whose name were Yitzchak, one was Yitzchak ibn Giat, one was the Rif. And he writes a Sefer Halacha. He's a Paitan, he's a poet, he's a Posek, he's a Rosh Hashiva. He writes 300 poems. Remember, Spanish Jews are paitanim. You get up and daven. Even your average Jew, you're expected not just to daven, but to make a piyut up on the spot. Or certainly earlier in the Egyptian Geniza, we have evidence of that. But piyut is something which is a very popular skill that's expressed there to add to the liturgy. Anyway, he writes halachic works that are quoted wildly by Rishonim. Anyone that's read the Ramban, anyone that's read the Baal HaMor, anyone that's read the Rashba, any of the later Spanish Rishonim, they're always quoting his Perush on Shas. Now, what does this have to do with Parshas Toldos?
Well, his name was Yitzchak, and he wrote Voluminous Works. And at some point, these two were published, and one of the names of the Sefer was called Mea Shearim. So Yitzchak founds the area called Mea Shearim, which of course becomes the namesake for the modern day Mea Shearim, because the modern day Mea Shearim was established during Parshas Toldos. So that's one of the reasons they called the Mea Shearim. I'll maybe give a cross link to that shear in this shear. But Rabbi Yitzchak ibn Giat, this is now not the 20th century in Israel, the 18th, this is now the 11th century in Spain. His sefer that's collected ends up being called Mea Shearim.